Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Norm Diamond. Our producer is Patricia Kullberg. This morning's program is one I've been looking forward to for a long time. We have three excellent interviews for you. First, on the so-called anti-woke legislation that's attempting to stifle teachers and turn our schools into bland puppets on behalf of reactionary political overlords. Second, on what's really going on in Mexico and why the news we get about it here is so distorted and politically prejudicial. And third, on the consequences of the ever more bloated U.S. military budget and how we might respond. Our music today is a 50-year-old song from the Beach Boys that they called Student Demonstration Time. And more contemporary, we have music from a group I've been listening to, Kijarema. I'll play more of this Bay Area group with an interesting political history when we get into September in our 9/11 show on the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-supported coup that ousted a democratically elected, gently socialist government in Chile. And I want to remind you, if you enjoy our program, if you learn from it, are motivated by it, or other KBOO programming, funding for the station comes primarily from you, our listeners. Please show your support by contributing today, or even better, becoming a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321. And now to our program. In at least 15 states, governments have passed gag orders prohibiting classroom conversations about race, racism, and LGBTQ issues in public schools. Florida's Stop Woke Act has been at the forefront of these attacks on educators, attacks on progressive movements. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, our left and the law moles, review the history of that legislation and discuss recent challenges in the courts, as well as political resistance on college campuses. Jan?
Well, Mike, the wave of repressive legislation prohibiting what teachers can teach and what students can read and learn has been termed the new McCarthyism. I think we're still looking for the right term to capture these various reactionary laws passed in state legislatures, prohibiting teachers, including college teachers, from taking up topics offensive to many white nationalists and their political allies. Let's start with Florida's so-called anti-woke laws. In 2022, with the support of Governor Ron DeSantis, the Florida state legislature adopted a law known as the Stop Woke Act, an acronym standing for Wrong to Our Kids and Employees. So Mike, can you unpack this anti-woke act? Tell us what's in it before we turn to resistances to the law, including legal challenges.
It's really an effort to legislate good feelings.
That doesn't sound so bad, right? Is that supposed to put us to sleep? It's a national sedative, right? To keep us asleep from being awake.
You know, the facts like the fact that no Black people could get a housing loan in the 30s and 40s explicitly by law is something that makes people now feel uncomfortable, because the basis of wealth in the United States is your home. And there are all sorts of Black people who were completely qualified financially for loans but were explicitly banned by statutes from ever owning a home. So that's an unpleasant fact if you're a white person and you like to think that everybody is treated equally and that we live in a colorblind society. So rather than deal with the implications of that state of the law, it's better to ban any discussion of it. And let's pretend the law never existed.
I mean, part of what's striking about this and some of the other cousin legislation that's been promoted and passed by conservative legislatures is how it uses the language of racial justice to basically fight racial justice. Can you speak to that aspect of this act?
Well, yeah, it's like we hear over and over again Martin Luther King's statement about we need to be a colorblind society. And it's used in a boomerang fashion to get rid of any effort that would make things more equal or take into account the fact that for centuries, this country was built on the slavery and suppression of Black people and the extermination of natives. That's just what happened here. Even at the Supreme Court level, I know the first day of new Justice Jackson's appearance on the court last October was a discussion of Alabama's voting suppression laws and a challenge to the way they were drawn, which would have concentrated Black people in one particular district, allowing white people to have a slight majority in several other districts. And she came out against the notion that we should be colorblind in this process or pretend to be, because as she said, why shouldn't race be considered when drawing U.S. congressional district maps, given our long-running history of state-backed racist voter suppression and housing segregation? That's the reality. In fact, for originalists looking at the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed in order to enable Black people to become an effective part of our society. They were passed in the wake of the Civil War, which was fought about slavery and the economy of the South, which then hinged on and required slavery in order to prosper. That's a historical truth. But what these new laws want is to keep people from having to feel squirmy and unpleasant about this reality and never to be forced to talk about it or consider it.
So the case before the Supreme Court around affirmative action also has its parallel legislative dramas in many states around what's called diversity, equity, and exclusion programs in schools and in workplaces that have been around for a long time, but they're kind of the last bastion of affirmative action and attending to affirmative action in schools and workplaces and encouraging diversity in hiring and in programming in schools and university. So that's another proud frontier that DeSantis is proclaiming himself as on the vanguard of, dismantling these DEI programs, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and making them against the law in workplaces and schools in Florida. How do you see that as part of this as well and related to what the Supreme Court is doing around affirmative action?
Well, the right is losing the cultural war. They're losing it badly. Corporations have routinely now report on how well they're doing in terms of diversity and inclusion and how well they're doing in terms of climate change. This has become normal. It's called ESG, the environment, social, and governmental values. Now, of course, much of this is just paying lip service and isn't really sincere, but they've got to pay the lip service. It's not like they can avoid it. So these ideas are crushing the white nationalists who want to restore us all to the 1950s when men were men and women were women and Black people were all quiet except in the South and there was no problems outside the South.
That's how they portray the world.
Yeah, parenthetically, the reason why the 1950s were so wonderful that no one ever talks about is the fact that the United States was the only part of the world undamaged by war. So that meant that we had the only functioning factories, that we could set the prices for raw materials because nobody else was buying iron or steel. We could set the prices for finished goods because nobody else was making refrigerators or anything. And as a result, a union member in Los Angeles could not only support his whole family, he could send his kids to college and even buy a little beach house in Hermosa Beach. And a lumber worker here in Oregon could easily support his whole family and send his kids to college. Well, that was a very brief moment, because societies like Germany and Japan have been leveled, but they're quite capable of making factories. And when they did finally reconstruct themselves, they did so with newer factories than what we had. And the economy has, we have spilled off into the rest of the world, and are now competing with dozens and dozens of other countries on every single level, and don't have that uniquely privileged position anymore. That we're no longer protected by oceans anymore either. So if there's another war, we won't skate so clearly as we did in World War II.
Yeah, the economic shifts are always in the background of these culture wars and intersect them in very complicated ways. Let's talk about the legal challenges to the anti-woke law that DeSantis so proudly proclaims in his presidential campaign, that the ACLU and NAACP mounted a legal challenge to that law. Can you tell us about that and where that's
at? They're very effective legal challenges, and they're prevailed. Right now, the Don't Say Gay law was suspended in district court, and when the state appealed to the 11th Circuit, a very conservative court in Florida, didn't get anywhere. They were asked that the law be immediately put into effect, and it's not. So right now it's on hold for months or even years while the Court of Appeal considers it. But that's not the point of passing these laws. They are deliberately vague. They attack the First Amendment squarely on by being vague and by exercising viewpoint discrimination. That is to say, you can't express certain views because they might make somebody feel uncomfortable. These are all classic issues of the First Amendment, but the point is to make people nervous. The vagueness itself is a goal.
It's not just lazy lawyering.
Not at all, not at all. It means that it spreads a chilling effect. So like, it's a tremendous portion of people around the country, teachers, as many as 1 out of 4 have changed their policies on what they will teach as a result of the fear of legislation.
Because some of this legislation includes criminal penalties for teachers that are highly unlikely. It's kind of like the abortion laws that scare the hell out of people and push in a more conservative risk-averse direction, even within the latitude of the laws themselves.
Well, that's true. And so the laws, even though the laws are bad now and are not technically in effect, the University of Central Florida has drastically changed its curricula. We know about the AP, the College Board, has drastically cut back on its African-American studies components. There are changes everywhere, and particularly among grade school teachers who are freaked out by the possibility of suffering criminal penalties or civil penalties, or worse yet, losing their jobs. So the laws are having an effect, without a doubt. And even though the legal challenges have been very solid and pretty effective.
Can you say a bit more about the legal status of these laws that have been stayed by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and are in, they haven't acted on them, but they're in a kind of limbo state that hovers over people in very intimidating ways. But nonetheless, that's a kind of success to prevent these laws from being implemented.
Exactly. I mean, you've summarized it. It's kind of an uneasy limbo. They haven't been affirmed or denied, but like the University of Central Florida has removed all anti-racist statements from its departmental websites. It's had a profound effect, even though it's not technically the law of the land.
You know, the American Association of University Professors, AUP, including the Florida chapter, has also called out administrators and politicians, but also university administrators in the state, for not resisting these laws and not standing up to them. So I think we're all aware, those of us who are paying attention, to what DeSantis represents, his view of the world. But he has many collaborators and many who facilitate that kind of vision. And I think that AUP is calling for teach-ins and continuing resistance on campuses and legal challenges to these laws. Do you see any other hope for hard times here in terms of successful agitation as well as legal challenges?
Let's stop here and note how far LGBTQ people have come in the last 50 years from being, you know, absolutely banned by laws, as well as being humiliated whenever they would come out, to something that's widely accepted, particularly by young people now. It's just, it's a kind of an option that's now seen as one of the many ways of being human. It's
and gender fluidity, young people are more comfortable with gender fluidity and moving away from a kind of rigid way of looking at gender differences, and are more comfortable with the fight against racism. So in a way, this is not so much about young people being uncomfortable with this history, but their parents and elders who,
exactly,
in many cases, don't want young white kids either to know about the history of these struggles and the kind of alliances that were so inspiring to many of us growing up, and as we finally learned this history and wanted to join forces with marginalized groups in fighting for a better world.
But what strikes me vividly, with particularly when I looked at these books, is the notion of intersectionality. Because 40% of the banned books have to do with sexual issues, and 40% have to do with race issues. But they're both concepts that are being banned. But I think it's provided us with an opportunity. And what's happening is critical race theory, which was an obscure notion dreamed up in Harvard and UCLA law schools in the 90s, is now the idea that there are laws that contain within them, without using the word black or white, an inherent form of racism, is getting more widely known and more widely accepted. And the whole concept itself is no longer buried away in academia, but it's in the streets. So there are opportunities presented by all these laws of us to push back in the same way that Margaret Sanger and people pushed back against the Comstock laws, and ultimately prevailed in the 1920s and 30s.
Well, I want to conclude today by sending our congratulations to the graduating class of the new school in Florida, and encourage people to go online and share in the video that's available that of their wonderful celebratory and joyous alternative graduation that campus that has been basically taken over by DeSantis and the Florida legislature and their efforts to turn it into a Christian nationalist paragon of education, stripped of any critical thinking whatsoever. And the students are fighting and faculty are fighting that. And one expression of that resistance was their celebration, their graduation celebration last week, which is just delightful to watch online. And these brave students in their full regalia, rainbow regalia, it was kind of street theater and serious solemn ceremony at the same time. And they are to be congratulated. And they're the hope for the future and for a better world. So we'll end by raising a glass to them.
Right on.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow this.
We will, certainly. It's going to be a part of our lives for the next decade.
Whether we like it or not.
student demonstration spar. Down to Isla Vista, where police felt so harassed, they called the special riot squad. The LA County Sheriff, when there's a riot going on.
That was a bit of Student Demonstration Time by the Beach Boys from way back in 1971. Before that, we heard Old Mole's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker on anti-woke legislation and our response. Next, we turn to Mexico. You may have noticed that Mexico has been much in the news, both around changes to its electoral system and around drugs coming into the U.S. But are we getting an accurate picture from U.S. media? You've heard Old Mole Luisa Martinez on Venezuela, and even at times on location in Latin America. Here, she interviews José Luis Granados Ceja, a journalist living in Mexico, about whose interest and what policies are behind the distortions in U.S. media coverage. The interview mentions a couple of things that might need clarification. When she asks about AMLO, that's a very familiar way in Mexico of speaking of that country's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO. And when she and José Luis talk of the disappeared students, they're referring to the 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College who are on their way to a protest in 2014, were stopped by police, and never heard from again. The Mexican military, together with drug traffickers, have been implicated. Here, then, is Luisa Martinez with José Luis Granados Ceja.
Hey, everybody. This is Luisa. I have the pleasure of speaking to my friend and comrade, José Luis Granados Ceja. He is a journalist and political analyst based in Mexico City. He's a staff writer with Venezuela Analysis, covering regional and international issues, and writes a monthly opinion column for the Mexico Solidarity Project, which I recommend everybody subscribe to. He's currently pursuing a master's degree in the defense and promotion of human rights at la Universidad Autónoma de la Ciudad de México. So thanks so much for joining us.
Really happy to be here.
Okay. So I thought we would start off addressing some of what's been written in English language media about AMLO and about Mexico and the political situation in Mexico. So I'll just read off a couple of recent headlines. One is Mexican High Court overturns reforms rushed through Congress. That was the AP. Migrant massacre in Ciudad Juarez is rooted in U.S.-Mexico border policing. Mexico army ignored cartel warnings before mass student kidnapping, emails show from The Guardian. Critics of Mexico's new electoral law changes say democracy is under attack. It's from NPR. And then also Mexico's new election reform is a blow to its young democracy, also NPR. So first off, can you please respond to some of what's been written in English language media about AMLO and about Mexico? And if it's easier for you, you can pick a topic and kind of start from there.
Sure. I think if we're looking at it in broad strokes, most of the coverage of Mexico tends to be one that I suspect is deliberately designed to paint a pretty grim picture about the country. We have to remember that corporate media outlets serve particular class interests. And in Mexico in 2018, we saw the election of a progressive president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Now, López Obrador represented a pretty radical break from the existing regime in Mexico. Mexico was dominated by neoliberal orthodoxy for decades, particularly starting in the 80s and really kind of deepening throughout the 90s and the 2000s. And so the arrival of López Obrador disrupted that, and it disrupted the class interests that many of these media outlets serve. Why? Because he's trying to govern for the great majority of this country, the working class, the campesinos, the low-income people, the middle class. And obviously, that affects the interests of people who have investments in the country, who are seeking to extract value out of Mexico, be it through cheap labor or through extraction of natural resources, or even having access to Mexico's internal market. And so this kind of coverage tends to be one that tries to make it seem like things are really bad in the country. And who shoulders the blame for that? Well, the president. And so, well, I want to focus on one in particular, which has been this accusation that is a democratic backsliding, or that, you know, is returning to an authoritarian situation. This one in particular, I think, is really quite telling, revealing about this strategy by the people, the masters behind these corporate media outlets. And what they're trying to do is paint this picture that Mexico is a country that is on the brink of falling into a dictatorship. If you analyze some of the lines that come out in some of this coverage, what do they say? That López Obrador is worried about his pet projects, that he's worried about who will be his successor. But the truth is, Morena, López Obrador's party, is incredibly popular. The successor candidate hasn't been chosen. López Obrador can't run for re-election. He's constitutionally limited to only one term. And no matter who the candidate is, according to polls today, Morena wins. And so this notion that he needs to jig the game, that he needs to mess with the country's democratic institutions in order to ensure that a successor from his party is elected in 2024, is an outright falsehood. But it is designed to kind of sow that seed inside people's minds that the next government, which more likely than not is going to be a Moreno government, is somehow lacking democratic legitimacy, somehow doesn't have a mandate to deepen the transformation that is already taking place inside the country. And we can talk about the other issues. You know, for example, you mentioned the one around the army not knowing about the forced disappearance of the students. Now, if that is true, there should be consequences. Did the army hide information? Did they not act fast enough? There should be action on that. But it's been López Obrador who's pushed for the Truth Commission. It's been López Obrador who's worked with the parents of the disappeared students. He's the one who's been pushing to get to the truth of the situation. And very recently, he said in his morning press conference that, of course, it's been difficult because you have to confront a mafia. That's the word he uses. There's a lot of powerful interests at play here. But that's the thing that's never get mentioned, right? That the one government that is actually interested in finding out the truth, that isn't trying to engage in a cover-up like the previous government of Enrique Peña Nieto did, is López Obrador. And so you can see this kind of skewed perspective. It all obeys certain interests inside of Washington, inside of Ottawa, Brussels. These are all very familiar to people who follow Latin American politics. It's about trying to ensure the status quo, which is favorable to the transnational companies, which is favorable to transnational capital. And obviously, that is not favorable to the people of Mexico. And that's what we're trying to change here.
So one topic that we, those of us who live in the United States, have heard quite a bit about in the news is fentanyl, right? Often hearing stories about the fentanyl crisis in the United States from people dying of overdoses, but then also placing the blame on Mexico, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the way that English language media distorts the fentanyl crisis and broadly how illegal drugs have influenced Mexican politics?
It's really quite tragic because anybody who follows the issue knows there is a very serious addiction opioid crisis in the United States. People are suffering the consequences of that. But it's unfortunate that in the United States, it seems like so many policymakers, as opposed to treating it as a public health issue the way it should be, trying to figure out a way to get people off their being addicted to these substances, to stop misusing substances. Instead, as is typical often, it seems, when it comes to the United States, the answer is some kind of militarist strategy, some kind of engage in armed conflict. Well, if only we can cut off the supply of the precursors or the supply of fentanyl through use of force, then we'll be able to solve this crisis. I mean, that's been the strategy of the war on drugs. And I think it's pretty much universally accepted now that that strategy has never worked, right? It's one that's focused only on affecting the supply. But somehow, year after year, the supply continues to be available, in fact, increases in many instances. In the particular case of fentanyl, when it comes to Mexico, it actually has to do with China. So much of the precursor chemicals used to make synthetic opioids come from China. And the U.S. put pressure on China in order to control its export. And that effectively did happen, right? It was much harder to get products from China into the United States in order to make these synthetic opioids. But of course, there's a market there, right? There are people who want to buy these drugs. And so who filled in that gap? Well, it was Mexican organized crime. You know, as long as there's some kind of lucrative business, organized crime will try to find a way to participate in it, right? That's why, you know, the selling of weed is no longer very profitable for Mexican cartels. So you actually see very little export of marijuana from Mexico to the United States. They go where the business is. And so they've been engaged in the import of these precursor chemicals, and then the export illegal to the United States. And so that makes the United States feel like this is the solution. We just need to stop organized crime groups from being able to get these drugs onto the streets. But what's their solution been? You know, I think it's frankly absurd that what really is a radical fringe idea has entered the mainstream. This all started with a group of Republicans, far-right Republicans, who started conspiring about engaging in unilateral military force against organized crime groups. And these aren't just, you know, Joe Nobody, right? We saw editorials and opinion pieces from the likes of Bill Barr, Mike Pompeo, right? These were high-ranking cabinet members in Trump's government. There was a Rolling Stone article that said that Trump was taking this proposal of unilateral military strikes inside Mexico as seriously, that he wanted to see this drawn up and engaged in this kind of conspiracy against the United States' neighbor as soon as he wins and enters office again, if he does win, right? That's really, really concerning. I mean, we should be honest what this represents. It's an act of war, right? You can't unilaterally strike a country in its own territory the way that they are proposing, right? And so they're using this issue of fentanyl as an excuse to try to intimidate Mexico and to engage in the U.S. style of the war on drugs, to go after the, you know, the so-called kingpin strategy. That was the strategy of Felipe Calderon. That was the strategy of Enrique Peña Nieto. And it didn't work, right? López Obrador is pursuing a different one. He always emphasizes that we need to attend to the root causes, right? To ensure that the organized crime groups can't so easily recruit from the Mexican population, you know, offering young people opportunities and jobs and education and trainings. And so that's been the strategy of the government, which of course also includes a strategy of going after the organized crime groups. I think that's important to recognize that there is a grassroots citizen demand for the state to intervene and try to provide more security to the population.
So can I ask, could you give us just a brief background about, the history of the United States and Mexican border? Has the U.S. tried to invade Mexico before?
Yeah, we've actually had instances of that. You know, we have to remember the Mexican-American War. What was it fought over? It was fought over Mexican territory, right? A lot of people point to 1846 as kind of the start of the war, and formally the war began. But to understand how we got there, we actually have to go back to 45, to the Texan quote-unquote revolution, right? This effort to break away from Mexico by people that had colonized that territory of Texas. And so this conflict was one that was driven by the United States' imperialist expansionist agenda, right? It wanted to seize this territory and found an excuse to do so and engage in a conflict, an armed conflict with a much weaker militarily country, right? The U.S. had started to modernize its armed forces and Mexico was kind of still stuck in the past. And as a result, Mexico lost half of its territory to the United States, right? I think that's the clearest example of just how the expansionist drive today, the U.S. isn't seeking to necessarily conquer new territories, but it is interested in maintaining and expanding its empire through neocolonialism. And I think some of what we're seeing in terms of U.S. interest in Mexico's energy sector is driven by this kind of neocolonial logic. But that actually isn't even the only instance of U.S. intervention in Mexico. It was actually the U.S. ambassador to Mexico during the Mexican Revolution, Henry Lane, who actually pushed for the coup d'etat against Francisco I. Madero, the president at the time, and successfully helped install Victoriano Huerta, a right-wing coup plotter, into power. Eventually, the Mexican Revolution managed to, you know, resolve that contradiction and push out Huerta as well, consolidate the gains of the revolution, have a new constitution, et cetera, et cetera. But it shows that the links that the United States would go to in order to ensure its interests inside are protected. And like, once again, you know, to go back to this issue of fentanyl, you know, it feels like its interests are being affected by the policies of this government. So it's using this as an excuse to once again try to intimidate the country and try to force it to abide by its dictates. But I think the other important thing to note as well is that the Mexican people are not going to let that happen. We are seeing now a resurgence of a sense of duty to defend our national sovereignty. I won't forget the massive demonstration in the Zócalo here in Mexico City, totally filled, the sidelining streets also filled with people. And López Obrador makes a call directly saying yes to cooperation, but no to interventionism, you know, and that we must defend national sovereignty. I think that's a pretty powerful statement. And to do so on that basis, that we're not going to allow the United States to step all over our dignity.
And just briefly explain, what is El Zócalo? Mexico City.
Zócalo is, anybody who's ever been to Mexico City, it's that big square at the center, at the heart of the city. It's surrounded by the cathedral on one side, the National Palace on the other, and the Palacio de Ayuntamiento on the other. So it's kind of like the heart of power in a lot of sense. It's actually built on top of the original location where the Aztec civilization began here in Mexico.
Thank you, Luisa Martinez with José Luis Granados Ceja. There's more to that interview that will play on another Old Mole soon. I promised you some music by Quijarema. Here's just a bit of their song, Para Matilde. The song was written to accompany a film on the life of Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. Finally, Old Mole Laurie Mercier speaks with Jeff Foe, founder of the Economic Policy Institute, and author of The Servant Economy and The Global Class War. about how gargantuan U.S. military budget and the new Cold War are exacerbating inequalities in climate catastrophe. What response can we make?
Good morning. With me is Jeff Bowe, who founded the Economic Policy Institute in 1986 and made it into the country's leading think tank on the political and economic issues that working Americans face. In 2003, he stepped down as EPI's president and is now Distinguished Fellow. Foe has taught and published on a wide variety of economic and political issues, and is the author or co-author of 6 books, the latest being The Servant Economy, Where America's Elite is Sending the Middle Class. He has written numerous articles for newspapers, magazines, and journals, one of which we'll discuss today that appeared in The Nation and on his website, The Dogs of War Will Eat Us. Welcome to KBOO, Jeff Bowe.
Well, great to have the invitation. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Jeff, as the Biden administration and Congress wrangle over the debt ceiling, neither side has proposed cuts to a bloated military budget that now costs over $1 trillion annually. You write about how both political parties continue to support this out-of-control war machine, including 800 bases in 80 countries. How and why does the Pentagon have such a hold on Congress?
Well, first, we need to understand that we are now launched wars on 4 fronts. We're at war with Russia, China, Iran, and everything on this terrorist list, which includes whoever the State Department doesn't like that week. So why did we get to this situation? I think partly what's happened was, especially since Vietnam, the governing class of this country has cleverly disconnected war from the ordinary lives of Americans. It started with Nixon, who stopped the draft, which meant that ordinary Americans didn't have to worry about, you know, them or their kids being dragged off to war. The second was Reagan, who taught the conservatives that they could borrow money to finance war and still keep the reputation as fiscal conservatives. And then I think finally, to make it bipartisan, Obama expanded the use of remote control drone warfare, where even the soldiers, you know, can fight just by pushing buttons and looking at a screen and have no immediate personal responsibility for the death and destruction. So what's happened is the average American has been disconnected. And when Biden launched this operation in the Ukraine, he said, well, you know, this is America. We stand up to bullies. Well, in fact, we haven't gotten off our couches because most Americans view war through their television set or online, completely divorced. It's a form of infotainment. And this has worked so far. But what's happening now was, while it worked, as long as the revenues into the government through borrowing or taxes could continue to finance the war machine and give a little bit to domestic spending, that is now being squeezed. U.S. economic power, I mean, and we have to understand that these fronts that I'm talking about with China and Iran and Russia, there's no threat to the average American here. These people are a threat to the governing class's global domination. And so when we think about military spending and we think about the war, it's very important to understand the separate interests here. There's the interest of the average American, and then there's the interest of the few Americans who run the empire, and they're quite different. The American empire is benefiting mostly Wall Street and the Pentagon profits and promotions, and has very little to do with the safety of the average American. In fact, as we see in the Ukraine already, the threat of nuclear war has been endangering the safety of the average American. But what's happened in the world is U.S. economic power is shrinking. And as we can't use the leverage of finance as strongly as we used to, we're looking more and more to military power to dominate. And military power has always been important, but the dollar has been an instrument of U.S. governing class domination in the world. And now that is a problem. 30, 40 years ago, the United States still produced 40% or so of the world's GDP. We are now at 15%. China is at 16%. So we don't have the leverage. And you can see this in the weakness of our efforts to put economic constraints on Russia and Iran. We're not as strong as we used to be. So the empire needs more military power in order to keep its domination. Meanwhile, on the domestic side, the domestic problems are getting more and more expensive. You cannot deal with climate control. You cannot deal with inequality. You cannot deal with the social divisions. You cannot deal with the insurrections that are going on in the United States without looking at, without thinking about investing a lot more money in these solutions. And we've got a climate control problem that can't be solved if we're at war with China and Russia. It just cannot be solved. So if you're worried about climate change, this war is going to destroy the little opportunity we have to deal with that.
Well, Jeff, your previous books, The Servant Class and The Global Class War, identify these economic elites and their policies that have destroyed the U.S. middle class and impoverished much of the world over the past 40 years. And to what extent does the blank check for the war industry accelerate this growing inequality?
Oh, I that's what's going on now. I mean, what has happened is that if you tap into the dialogue and the discussions going on within the defense establishment, I mean, they're just tearing up the pea patch here. They've got contracts that are just pouring out of the Pentagon, and it's not just for to help the Ukrainians. These are long term contracts. It's locking in Raytheon and Lockheed and their financial investors for a long period of time. Just for example, the U.S. Navy says, well, in order to defend us against China and Russia and everybody else, we're going to need, something like 200, 300 more big, heavy warships. And of course, we're not going to be able to produce them until something like 2040. What this means is the next 35 years of huge outlays for defense in order to fulfill this, this empire of domination. The bottom line here is that we used to be a way to afford to do both. We didn't do very well on the domestic side, but the governing class put out enough money to keep things quiet. And once they got rid of the draft, people didn't have to worry about their own vulnerability to war. They got rid of the taxes, so they're not paying for the war. And Obama got rid of even soldiers having to watch the destruction that they're doing. Once we got rid of that, it was, it was manageable, but now it's not getting manageable.
Well, let's just look at the expanding war in Ukraine. Yep. Now with U.S. advisors there. Explain the folly of continuing to send more weapons, missiles, and fighter jets to Ukraine. You point out that the United States can't even supply what weapons it has promised to Ukraine and Taiwan, much less engage in expanding wars.
We are over our head in just the Ukraine. And of course, it starts the way it starts in all of these wars that we've been involved in. And that is the the leaders saying, oh, listen, we're not going to get deep into this. We're just going to give a little aid on the side. And then, of course, once you make this commitment, once Biden says, well, we're going to be with the Ukraine, you know, whatever it takes. Well, of course, it takes more than they have told us. First, they said that it wouldn't be, you know, the high-tech weapons. And then they put the high-tech weapons in. Then it went up and up and up. And now it's the F-16s. And when you put this, here's part of the mechanism of escalation. You put these weapons into the Ukraine. You've got to train people. And it's not enough to bring them to Fort Bragg or something and give them, you know, 3 weeks training. You've got to be there with these people. And so more and more Americans are going to get sucked in to the war itself. And then, of course, there's going to be deaths. You don't hang around in a war zone without the risk of dying. So what happens then? Then it's going to be, oh, the Russian missile hit an American. And, you know, and then it just escalates up and up and up from that. And in this case, you know, the original Cold War, at least you had adults on both sides. But now it's, you know, it's getting close to the point where it's out of control. And it may be out of control now. Biden has made so many belligerent statements about the Ukraine war, including things like, you know, bringing Putin to international war crime trial and all that. This is just lunacy. But we know from the past, from Vietnam, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Somalia, from Lebanon, from all of these places, that you know, once you start these things, they have a life of their own. David Halberstam wrote that book a long time ago about Vietnam, and he made the point that actually the military did not want to go in at the beginning, but it was the civilian people in the White House who said, well, we'll go in, and if it's not working, we'll come out. Well, once you go in, the military takes over, because now you've told them their job is to kill and, you know, and triumph. So,
And there are also the unintended consequences and the blowback that always occur after these interventions and wars. And you write about the demonization of Putin, much like the United States demonized Saddam Hussein, and this kind of comic book logic that reduces everything to us versus the good guys, us as the good guys versus the bad guys.
And comic book is about the level of our national discourse on this. I mean, I'm not just talking about, supermarket newspapers. I'm talking about the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and all of these places. They're just, they're incessant. We're the good guys. So anything that we do is acceptable. We invade other countries. Hey, that's okay because we're the good guys. Well, once you accept that's the comic book logic, once on the first page, you read, you know, you see the first image of who the good guy is and who the bad guy is, then everything else follows. And there's no, you know, room for anything else. It's like the anti-war movement is, there is no anti-war movement in the United States. And partly it's because, as I said, what Reagan and Nixon and Obama did to disconnect people from the war. But also partly it's because, ironically, well, it's because the left in America has not really grappled with what a wise person said to me once, and that is, in war, there are two losers. It's the people who lose and the people who thought they won. And the thing about this is that if there's going to be an anti-war movement, it's got to start focusing on what it's doing to America, what it's doing to Americans. You know, most of the left critique, and it's, you know, not, it's more, let's admit it, it's marginal in politics, has been on the horrors that we're raining on the rest of the world. It's certainly, you know, a very, very, very important point. But the way to move the empire here, you know, we're in the heart of the empire, the heart of the beast here. And the way to move the empire is the way it was finally moved over Vietnam. And that is, it was about what it was doing to this country. And we got to get back to that. And what it's doing to this country is preventing us from dealing with climate change, inequality, international competitiveness, all of those things. And, you know, that's the real stake. It's not so much the marginal budget item, but it's what it's doing to this country that is diverting from the issues that we need. We know we could have had a deal with Russia. And that is, Ukraine stays out of NATO and Russia allows the Ukraine to grow and, you know, whichever way it wants to. And that was the Cold War solution in Austria. It was the Cold War solution in Finland. But Biden rejected it. And so the Ukrainians are now destroying their country, destroying their families, the terrible stuff that's going on there, in order for the Ukraine to join NATO. You know, I'm waiting for the New York Times to ask the question of all these people who are suffering in the Ukraine, do you think this was worth it? And, you know, no human being would answer that it was worth it.
Well, Jeff Foe, we appreciate you joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We will direct people to read your recent pieces, including The Dogs of War Will Eat Us. And we hope that your work will motivate the left and many others to join in halting this and many other wars as we face a very dangerous new world indeed, thanks to the United States. Thanks again, Jeff Foe.
Thanks, Lori.
It's been a full program. Thanks to Old Mole's Lori Mercier, Luisa Martinez, Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker, and their guests, Jeff Foe and Jose Luis Granado Ceja. Thanks always to the valiant KBOO staff. We'll go out with a bit more of the Beach Boys. This has been Norm Diamond, hoping you stay safe and stay active.
Useless wars and racial strife, but next time there's a riot, well, you better